Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. Imagine that you're a personal trainer. You've been in the industry for 5, 6, maybe 7 years. You've put in all the reps all the time, got your certifications, maybe got a degree, done your continuing education, you know, stacked the CEUs to be able to keep them, pass those exams, right? And then one day, a client walks up to you with their phone out and they say, hey, I saw this random dude online. It goes by Dr. Joel Seedman, and he's saying that squatting past 90 degrees is actually bad for you. He's telling me that full range of motion is completely overrated and that my knees could get destroyed if I would squat below parallel. What do you say? Do you try to push back? Do you Google it right on the spot to see what he's actually finding and saying? Or do you quietly wonder if maybe you've actually been teaching squats wrong the whole time, right? Or what if you're a strength coach who just started following Seedman online? The guy has NFL players and former NFL players, former pro athletes that's trained with him. He's got a PhD. He writes these long, dense, scientific-sounding posts that use terms like neuromuscular recruitment patterns and kinesthetic feedback loops. And you think, man, this guy must know something that the mainstream does not know. He's got to be hiding something, right? Well, here's what I'm going to tell you today on this episode, not only backed by peer-reviewed research and exercise science that stood up to decades of scrutiny at this point, but also that Joel Seedman is not a misunderstood visionary. He is not the guy who has cracked the code to the rest of the industry and refuses to not acknowledge what he is. And I'm going to make a case pretty thoroughly here today on this episode, is that the clearest example of how fitness pseudoscience gets packaged, marketed, and sold to professionals who should know better, but they're really just selling this pretty little thing that makes you think that you're missing out on the secret sauce. And the reason I'm spending an entire episode on this isn't because I have beef with the dude, okay? I will admit, I think a lot of the stuff he does is absolutely ridiculous, redundant, it's stupid, I think it's a waste of time. I have no personal vendetta against him, but it's because the fitness industry's credibility problem runs through influencers like Joel Seedman. And if you're a coach, a trainer, gym owner, maybe just a person that just loves training hard and, you know, wants to see the industry do good things, you know, generally here, I'm here to help serve other people with real bodies. I'm working with real humans, right? I'm working with the average Joes. I'm working with young athletes. You may be in the same boat, that you need to be able to recognize this pattern that Seedman is selling and be able to stop it and learn how to navigate it when it comes to actually talking to your own clients. Because this is probably going to be a conversation that's going to happen at some point, whether it's Joel Seedman or some other Fruit Loop that's doing something crazy, right? It's not that this is just at Joel Seedman. He is just the guy right now in the fitness industry that seems to be making a mockery of what we do for a living, especially for many of us that happen to live, breathe, and train people for a living, and then obviously enjoy our own training. So let's get into it. Now, welcome to the Thirst More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. And as I mentioned, today we're going to go into the most polarizing aspect of the fitness and sports performance area, and that's going and talking about Joel Seedman, who has his PhD. He's the founder of Advanced Human Performance and the man whose Instagram and YouTube content has sparked debate across every corner of strength and conditioning based space and in our world. And you're going to look at his core claims, we're going to look at his core claims, and then we're going to stack them against the literature, and we're going to talk about what the existence of influencers like him means for the industry and for the career of personal training, sports performance, strength and conditioning, if you happen to be working in the fitness industry. So let's go into this specifically. And so let's start with the basics here, because I do think the context matters to begin with, is that Joel Seedman holds a PhD in exercise science from the University of Georgia. He is the founder and CEO of Advanced Human Performance, or AHP, as he likes to call it, based in Atlanta. And he has worked with professional athletes, so NFL players, NBA players, combat sport athletes. And he uses those client relationships heavily in his marketing that you'll notice if you've ever seen his stuff. And on the surface, this sounds like a legitimately credentialed professional. Like if you just go and look at his page, you know nothing about this individual. You can see his following, the way he has things presented. You know, he's got a PhD, he has certifications, right? He has all the things that you would expect to hopefully see as somebody that has a lot of credentials and a lot of buy-in behind what he's doing. And they're, you know, they're not fabricated. And in any fair analysis, we do have to acknowledge that, right? To my knowledge, he's not bought his followers or anything like that. You know, maybe he has, I don't know. But when you've got almost 500,000 followers, I would like to think that, you know, majority of those are legit. And to me, here's where it gets a little bit complicated, is that Sieben has built his brand around what he calls the eccentric isometrics and a broader system he labels chaos training. And his social media presence is built almost entirely on visually bizarre, highly complex exercise variations that you've probably never seen anywhere else. And think about here about pressing on a Swiss ball, squatting with bands, pulling you out of alignment in all these weird ways, doing deadlifts in positions that look more like a performance act than any kind of actual deadlift or strength and conditioning. He had this thing where these things were twisting on the barbells while he was like squatting or holding it. I can't remember anymore, but it just looked like helicopter wings on the barbell, right? And he pairs every video that he does and that he shoots with a lengthened out, jargon heavy caption full of all the pseudoscientific explanations for why these movements are superior to what everyone else in the industry is doing. Well, his stuff is the secret sauce. And he has a book called Movement Redefined and retails for around $300 to my knowledge. And his online programs are priced also at a premium. So he charges significant rates for both his coaching and his consulting and just overall the products that he happens to be making. Now, none of that alone is evidence of wrongdoing, in my opinion, right? Premium pricing and unconventional training aren't inherently problematic. Everybody's got a little something they do differently. Maybe they've got something they're really drawn to, right? But the issue that I have, and this is the core of the episode here today, is what happens when you actually hold these specific claims up to scientific literature. Because what you'll find is a consistent pattern of very bold, confident, absolute claims about how the body works, and with either zero peer-reviewed citations, selective use of research, especially with Sieben, or outright contradiction of what the evidence actually shows. And to me, that is dangerous, especially for the average person from the outside looking in. Not just for the people that he trains specifically, but for the coaches and the trainers who absorb his content or happen to run across his content and then pass it downstream into their clients or try to implement it, right? So let me walk you through the three major claim areas that I could really kind of find from his content. And I'm going to do this a little bit of a systematic-based approach. I'm going to talk about the claims. I'm going to talk about the counter evidence and then the practical implication for us as coaches and trainers. And so let's start first with the most controversial one that I think majority of people have probably heard of, at least in the past. So the first one is that Sieben's most well-known and most controversial claim is what he calls the 90-degree rule. And the basic assertion of this is that squatting, pressing, and pulling past 90 degrees of joint flexion is biomechanically inferior, increases your risk of injury, and should be avoided in favor of stopping movement at or around a 90-degree joint angle. And he says, going into deeper causes, and you know, I'm definitely paraphrasing here from all the stuff that I've kind of gathered from him, is that dysfunction in the kinematic sequence that causes the brain to misfire, and then it accumulates inflammation in every single joint when you do that. All right, so let's actually take that claim that doing stuff past 90 degrees is bad for your body, it's bad for your joints, right? It's going to wreak havoc on your body. Let's stack that up against the literature. And first is going to be squatting and just the overall range of motion of it. Now, from what I could find, a 2013 study published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research by Bloomquist and colleagues compared full depth squats to partial squats over a 10-week period, and the results were that greater gains in muscle cross-sectional area, strength, and functional capacity in the full range group were seen. The partial group showed smaller hypertrophy responses and did not demonstrate superior outcomes on any measured variable. Now, this is not a fringe finding. It also replicates a 2017 meta-analysis by Kubo and colleagues found that full range of motion training consistently produced greater hypertrophy across multiple muscle groups compared to partial range training. And then also in a 2020 study by Schoenfeld and Grick in the Journal of Human Kinetics confirmed that training muscles in a lengthened position, which requires a full range of motion, mind you, may actually be superior for hypertrophy due to greater mechanical tension at long muscle lengths. So what about the injury risk? Seidman argues that going past 90 degrees increases joint stress and injury potential. So let's kind of look at things from that perspective. Now, the data on the knee joint stress in deep squatting has been studied pretty extensively as well. So a review, again, by Schoenfeld, published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research in 2010, one of the most cited analyses on squat mechanics that we have, found that while compressive forces on the knee do increase at deeper squat depths, these forces are well within the tolerances of healthy knee structures, and that shallow squats actually place greater shear forces on the anterior cruciate ligament, so your ACL, and patellar tendon in certain positions. Now, also, in a 2014 study by Hartman and colleagues in sports medicine, they explicitly stated that deep squats, when performed with proper technique, do not damage passive tissues and are unlikely to cause injury in healthy individuals. In fact, the review actually found that deeper squats were associated with improved long-term knee joint health compared to partial depth alternatives. Now, here's the practical implementation side of this, and I think this is important for us to take away. So I can read off studies Seidman does. You know, I'm obviously going to find studies that back my claims and what the majority of the industry is doing, and he's going to try to find studies and research to back what he's obviously trying to sell and promote. This is where I think the practical implication piece comes in. That if one of your athletes or clients comes to you having been coached underneath Seidman's 90-degree system, you know, hypothetically here, there are a few things happening. One is that they may have atrophied their capacity for full range of motion because range of motion is a skill that is obviously going to require practice just in general, right? If you don't use it, you'll lose it. And range of motion and mobility is no different here. Then number two, they may have been trained in patterns that don't transfer to sport because almost no athletic movement in the real world stops cleanly at 90 degrees, right? Now, I will say we do know that there is research out there also that backs that quarter/half squats have better transfer over into sprinting performance. Well, yes, that's because we're mimicking joint angles and we're looking at a very specific task. But those athletes are probably still also doing other things in 90 degrees or past 90 degrees in their general training, especially in a general training block, right? We would probably do those quarter half squats much closer to competitions because it's more specific. And then we do stuff that's more general as we get further away from training. So that's just how training ebbs and flows to begin with. And by no means are most people intentionally breaking down joint angles and doing it and applying it across all exercise variations just because of this joint stress. Okay. So that's where I want to be very clear here. Yes, there are obviously certain case uses for using decreased range of motion in particular things, especially if you're after certain joint angles for certain performances. I've definitely programmed some of these myself as well for certain people and certain athletes. I do think it has merit, but again, just remember, it's not a blanket statement that I'm applying to every exercise for every single athlete to sell a particular product. All right. Now, number three, they may have spent significant money on the premise that avoiding depth was actually protecting them when the evidence suggests the opposite may actually be true. And here's the thing about Seidman's response when he's challenged on this from everything that I've seen on his social media is he walks it back and he says, oh, I never said anyone should train this way. It's about individual assessment, right? He's been quoted as saying that. But as when 80 or 90% of his Instagram content is built on pushing this methodology as being superior, that backtrack doesn't necessarily hold up. Now, the 90-degree rule is not a clinical insight. It's not supported by the body of evidence that we have. It is a marketing hook wrapped up in biomechanical language, and coaches need to call it what it is. And furthermore upon this, the thing that also really makes me mad is that he uses random things of his own beliefs as well to sell this stuff. And most recently was the one that he definitely used with his religious beliefs, that he saw these claims in the Bible, basically. I'm not going to go into deep of that because I'm not going to bring in religion into my podcast. I'm not going to do that, but I think it's very, very snake oily to do that, to prey upon people's beliefs, to use that to sell a system or something that you believe in from a training perspective, right? So that also does not sit well with me as well. And that's one of the things that he kind of does, is he tries to play on people's emotions as well. All right, let's move into the next thing. This is Seaman's second major brand pillar that he focuses on, and that's the chaos training and the use of maximal instability, conflicting movement patterns, and destabilized environments during compound strength movements. And so we're talking about pressing on Swiss balls, doing bilateral exercises with one arm pushing while the other one pulls, executing quad patterns with heavy bands pulling you out of position mid rep, right? And the sales pitch is that this creates superior neuromuscular recruitment, better proprioceptive feedback to the individual, and more functional carryover to sport than stable traditional loading patterns. Okay, so let's see what the research actually has to say on this. So the stability performance relationships has been studied for decades at this point as well, and the findings are also very consistent. Bellum and Collado published a comprehensive review in 2012, and in that Journal of Human Kinetics, they examined instability training across multiple populations. Their conclusion was that instability training is inferior to stable training for developing maximal strength and power, period. Okay, having a stable surface is what you needed to maximize your strength and power development. While unstable surfaces do increase core muscle activation in isolation, that activation does not translate to greater functional strength or output or improved sport performance, right? So yes, you might be able to acknowledge that there is more activation, but that makes sense because you're standing on something that is unstable. So your body is trying to find a way to ground itself basically and hold still, right? And so a foundational principle of motor learning, specificity of training, is directly violated by chaos training methodology. So if you want to be strong, stable, and powerful in dynamic athletic movements, you need to train the movement patterns under load in stable, progressively overloaded conditions, right? The research on this is not ambiguous, all right? So keep that in mind when we talk about the chaos training. And here is another angle that you could also take this, is that force production requires stability as a prerequisite. Okay, read that again. Force production, maximal force production, is going to require stability as a prerequisite. So when you are wobbling through a squat on an unstable surface or a Bosu ball or whatever, or fighting band tension pulling you sideways, or managing two conflicting limb patterns simultaneously while you're standing on a single leg or whatever, and then also limiting 90 degrees range of motion, mind you, the neuromuscular system allocates resources to stability at the direct expense of the force output. And so Bellum and colleagues also confirmed this in the 2010, finding that lower limb force output is significantly reduced during unstable versus stable conditions. So you're not getting actually stronger. You're getting better at managing chaos, which is a different skill that does not translate to sport or general performance outcomes the way that Seaman implies that it does. Now, is there any legitimate role for instability training? Possibly in specific rehabilitation context, particularly early stage, like proprioceptive training after ankle sprains or ACL reconstructions, limited instability work can have a place. Okay, I will say that. I've even had athletes do it standing on Arex pads and whatever after they come back for some kind of ankle rehab and ACL stuff. So very, very specific places can it be useful. But that is a narrow and a very small clinical application for a very few population. It is not a foundational training methodology that athletes or general population clients should be using, or that I'm even programming for that matter, right? And you shouldn't be either. And Seidman is not presented in that way with all of his social media posts. He presents the chaos training as a superior approach for elite performance. Evidence does not support that. Okay. And here's what makes this particularly problematic from a coaching perspective is that when a fitness professional sees a video of an NFL wide receiver doing, again, the Bosu ball press or whatever, the chains hanging off the barbell, and the visual signals that you get from that is, whoa, you know, like that's awesome. That's a professional athlete doing this. That guy runs sub 4.4, maybe even a sub 4.3 in the first 40-yard dash. Like, he's in awesome shape. He's incredibly lean. He's an elite athlete. So the exercise must be doing something, right? And this is one of the oldest cognitive traps in all of the exercise science field and strength conditioning field, is what researchers call the illusionary correlation. Okay. The athlete is elite not because of the instability training that they're getting, in this case from Seidman. The athlete is already elite despite it. And, or more accurately, because the foundational strength, speed, and skill work that underlies their overall athletic performance, most of which looks nothing like what Seidman posts on Instagram. So they might be able to do this because, again, they're elite athletes. They have elite neuromuscular systems. They have elite adaptations. They have trained for a long period of time, right? They have a good general foundational base of elite athleticism their whole lives. So when you throw some circus trick at them, they're going to make it look relatively easy because you have the genetic elite doing it. Right? That doesn't mean that it's going to make them a better athlete. That's why they're a good athlete. It doesn't work that way. Now, also, if you know Dane Miller from Garage Strength, he's also got, obviously, legitimate credentials in Olympic weightlifting and sports performance. And he puts this very well in something that he did on this kind of topic, is that Seidman's movements may have good intentions, but they don't transfer well to any sport or skill. So the visual novelty is just for his branding, and the branding works, but branding and efficacy are not the same thing. They are not the same thing. And to me, that's what bothers me deep down. So, you know, as a coach or trainer, our job is to see past the visual spectacle and then at the end of the day ask, what adaptation is this exercise producing? You know, in what population, over what kind of time frame, and what does the evidence actually say about its efficacy compared to its alternatives? That question alone would filter out most of what Seidman's posts are and what they do. If you can just look at everything he does through that lens of, you know, what adaptation is he after? What population would this work with? How long do I have to work with this individual or athlete or client? And what does the evidence say about that particular type of training compared to the other types of training that could be potentially used? And usually most of the exercises are not going to stand up to any of those questions compared to just general quality strength training and strength conditioning principles that we have. All right. So let's talk about something that gets also overlooked in these conversations, and that's the business model side of things. Because by understanding how Seidman monetizes his brand, is essential to understand why his content looks the way that it does, at least in my opinion. So Seidman's Instagram and YouTube are not primarily educational platforms. Again, this is my opinion. They are marketing funnels at the end of the day. So every post, every video that he makes, every long-form caption is designed to direct traffic to his book and his materials, his online programs, his consulting services, and his coaching packages. That's what they're all to do. If you go read them, that's really what he's trying to push you towards. And this is not a criticism necessarily unique to Seidman, but this is how most fitness influencers operate just in general. But it matters because it means the content that you're consuming is not constructed with your learning as the primary goal. It's constructed to make you reach out for your wallet, be able to purchase something, or think that, hey, he's hiding some kind of special information. I want to have access to that information, so I'm going to purchase this material. And the design of his content is very sophisticated if you really, really think about it. He uses what's called an appeal to authority structure. Okay. He leads with the fact that he has a PhD. He name drops these NFL, NBA, former pro level athletes. He uses dense, heavy academic sounding language. He posts with absolute confidence, right? He is very stern in the way that he talks, and he does not hedge. right? The only thing he'll say is buy the ebook, read the ebook, reference the ebook. He doesn't say, here's one perspective. Okay. He's just saying, this is how it works. And if you disagree, you don't understand the science, so go buy my book. And that pattern of communication, you know, the absolute confidence, the dismissiveness towards his critics, and the jargon as a barrier to entry for most people is a red flag in any kind of educational context, just in general. But he's using that obviously to sell things at the end of the day. Now, legitimate experts express uncertainty here as well. They cite conflicting evidence. They acknowledge the limits of what could actually be known in that particular movement pattern or knowledge or what they happen to know. And the pseudoscientific communicators do the opposite in this case, because uncertainty is going to be bad for your sales. You basically have to double down consistently to make sure you keep selling, because if you contradict yourself, now anything that you're selling or promoting that's based upon that claim is now not going to sell, because it's relying on the information that you're claiming, right? And so he has to double down on majority of his stuff whenever he does this. And so let's talk about his $300 ebook here, or book, whatever, which one it is. Maybe in both forms, I'm not even sure. But it's called Movement Redefined. All right. And so I want to be very precise and clear here. I'm not saying the content of the book is worthless. I haven't read hardly any of it. I'm not going to read hardly any of it. And I'm not going to pretend that I have. Okay. What I am saying is that the pricing structure of that product combined with his premium online programs represents a significant financial barrier that his marketing relies on, creating a sense of exclusive, superior knowledge to justify. So he's using his quote-unquote expertise with these hard claims, this expertise, these things that he seems to know the most about, and he seems to have the secret sauce in this. And he's willing to tell you the secret sauce if you're willing to pay the $300 and then read the secret sauce so that you can implement it. You can't just get it from him directly. You got to pay and then do the research and the reading on your own. And the Dunning-Kruger effect works in two directions here. So Sieben's audience often includes clients and coaches who don't yet have the scientific literacy to evaluate his claims, which is exactly the population that happens to be most vulnerable to purchasing his confident masquerading as expertise. And I want to say something very clear and nuanced here as well, is because this is important for how we think about all of the fitness content and that's out there, not just Sieben's. But being creative is a character flaw. Being willing to experiment with unconventional exercise is not a character flaw. Charging a premium for coaching services is not a character flaw. What becomes the problem, both ethically and practically, in my opinion, is when those things get wrapped in scientific authority that the science does not support. And then it's sold to a public that lacks the tools to evaluate the claims and promote it with an absolutism that discourages all critical thinking, okay? He's very big on that. He really comes after people that have their own critical thinking, because you're not buying into his dogma. You're not being the sheep. You're not following what he says, so you have to be wrong. And that's the line, in my opinion. And Sieben has been on the wrong side of it consistently and publicly for years at this point, which is why different researchers, coaches, and other people in the field have definitely kind of came after him. You know, some of those people being Dr. Mike Israetel, Lane Morton, Zach Telelander have all weighed in against specific claims that he has made. So this is not just me. These are other people. I'm just giving my two cents here, I guess, into this whole issue. Now, what does this mean for us as fitness professionals, or even just somebody that happens to be listening to this podcast episode today? It means that our credibility is always downstream of the sources that you endorse. So if you're sharing Sieben's content with your clients or using his methodology without being able to explain the evidence behind it or the lack thereof for most of it, you are taking on a reputational risk every time you happen to do these things. And the internet does not forget, and your clients will eventually figure out when something they were sold doesn't work. And for me personally, I think there's a lot of people that are starting to really kind of come against Sieben, although he still has a massive following and he's still got his cultish people that are supporting what he does. But the big thing here is that we obviously look through everything with a specific lens, and like, you know, that's why there can be some stuff that's good about training at 90 degree joint angles, right? But I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm going to adopt that methodology, especially to every single exercise with every single, like, that's not the way that the human body moves and how it works and how you should be writing training programs, right? If you're providing individuality, but you're so bought into this one training method, you can't even use a regular dumbbell bench press because it goes past 90 degrees. Like, come on, bro, get out of here, right? That's when you have to really start to think, how are people buying into this? When 99% of the fitness population that is seeing other strength and conditioning information is doing a general, let's say, dumbbell bench press, for example, but this guy thinks that you got to train at 90 degrees and have your foot on some wobbly surface with your back on there. And yeah, they're right. Like, why is his little 1% always better? And we want to make sure that we can look at his content and maybe get some ideas. Okay. I will say that I've seen some stuff on there. I'm like, hey, that's actually not a bad exercise. I'm not going to do the 90 degree part, but he's onto something here maybe, right? Even I can admit that. So let's pivot here a little bit, because at the end of the day, I didn't make this episode just about tearing something down. That's not what I do. That's not what this podcast here is for. The goal is always to point you or have anyone listening to this to the direction of what's actually going to work and help you be better. So let's talk about the training principles that are consistently supported by the literature, the ones that are actually going to produce results that transfer to sport and function, and that your clients deserve at the be the center and main driving factor behind their programming that you're doing. So principle number one is just going to be quality progressive overload being the master variable. Now, I have a previous episode on progressive overload, more than just adding weight. I would recommend you check out that episode where I go into an hour of how to progressively build your training programs out more than just adding weight and adding repetitions. But progressive overload is the single most consistently supported principle in resistance training research, and it's progressive overload, the systematically increasing the demand placed on the body over time through load, volume, or density. Okay. Radames and colleagues' landmark position statement for the NSCA in 2009 established this very clearly, and it has been replicated across populations, different training methodologies, and timeframes, that no chaos training methodology has demonstrated superior adaptations to well-programmed progressive overload. Nothing has. Principle number two is going to be full range of motion builds stronger, more resilient tissues. So as we covered earlier in that segment, that full range of motion training, when appropriate for an individual's mobility and structural anatomy, of course, you know, for their individual person, produces greater hypertrophy, better joint health outcomes, and more functional strength than partial range alternatives. The clinical exception for this is real, that certain pathologies or acute injury stages require range restriction, but optimal for most healthy athletes and clients is full range, properly loaded, progressively advanced movement patterns. Okay. So there's certain things for me, for example, with my hip, my back, doing things in full range of motion, super heavy loaded will really angry my hip and back. So I can't do some of that. I can do with lighter stuff and I still try to do my best, but you know, I'm not going to just train to 90 degrees, and majority of people should not be. They should be training through a full range of motion as long as they are able to do so healthily and effectively. Principle number three is going to be that stable loading environments maximize strength adaptations. So force production, again, is maximized on stable surfaces with stable loading. This is not controversial, okay? Athletes getting stronger under a barbell on the ground is going to be what most of us think of, right? They don't get stronger because their platform or the thing they're standing on is wobbling. Instability tools can have a clinical role in specific rehab progressions, but they are not foundational performance enhancers. Stick with the barbell. Stick with the stable surface training, load up heavy movement patterns, and that will be able to help you with maximal strength and maximal force production. Now, principle number four is going to be the exercise selection should follow the principle of specificity. So the training specificity principle, so the adaptations are specific to demands of the training stimulus, right? Means that exercises should be selected based on what adaptations you're targeting and how those adaptations transfer to the goal of the athlete or the client. So an NFL wide receiver needs more speed, power, deceleration, cutting ability, right? And the exercises that build those qualities are different sprint mechanics, Olympic lifting variations usually, plyometrics, your heavy compound strength work, not a stability ball, Swiss bar press with weird band tension pulling in different directions, right? It's not going to do it. Stick with the basics here, especially if you can mimic more of the change of direction, speed, agility stuff. Leave your strength training more general to cover those aspects of the sport. And then principle number five is that complexity should serve the adaptation, not the camera or the internet or your cell phone. Now, this is one that I think you should think about every single time that you evaluate a new exercise or methodology. And I'll be the first to tell you here, I love being on Instagram for watching other people do different exercises that they're not seen, not heard of, not thought of, and then me playing with them and then thinking about how could this potentially be useful. Okay, before I would ever give it to somebody, I'm going to try it myself. I highly suggest you check out my YouTube or my Instagram, because if I see something I do like, I do share it, right? I'll either share it, the person that made it, or I'll give them a shout out, or I'll post myself doing it and say, hey, I picked this up from so-and-so. I've really been liking it over a week, 2 weeks, couple sessions as a warm-up, you know, as a filler, as a main movement, whatever, right? So the thing that you need to ask is this complexity of the exercise that you're seeing serving the adaptation, or is it serving the visual novelty side of things? And is this harder because it's more effective, or is it harder because instability is inherently more cognitively demanding, right? Just having the instable service training stuff that we're talking about here. So those are two different things. And from a coding perspective, the answer to that question usually determines whether you're building athletes or just producing impressive looking content to post on social media, not actually using it to actually move the needle forward in any kind of shape, way, or form for the athlete or client. And the fitness industry as a whole has a recurring problem is that complexity is mistaken for having sophistication. And Seidman has monetized this confusion probably better than anybody else that's on social media that's even in the fitness industry right now. But confusion is not sophistication, okay? Doesn't mean that what he has is something special that we need to also have. The evidence-based simplicity applied consistently produces far better outcomes than the complex novelty that's applied inconsistently and at random, which is what most people are doing and what he is doing with majority of the stuff that you've probably seen. And I want to give you one more piece of research here because I think that this is important. So I found that a 2021 review published in Strength and Conditioning Journal examined the relationship between training complexity and actual performance outcomes across multiple sports. The finding was, pretty clear, robust at this point, and that's that athletes who trained on fundamental compound movements with progressive overload consistently outperformed those who trained on complex, multi-planar, novelty-based movements in measures of strength, power, and sport-specific performance. So complexity without any kind of general, just quality strength training base is not innovation. It's largely just noise that you're seeing on social media, and chances are they're probably selling something with that novelty that they are creating. So I want to spend this last segment here of the podcast talking directly to fitness professionals, if you happen to be a fitness professional, because everything that we've covered here today has direct implications on how we do what we do for a living. And so first, let's talk about the client education component here, because your clients are on the internet, believe it or not. They are using their cell phones and watching things on social media. You know, they watch TV. They use all the stuff. Okay, they're not idiots. They, chances are seeing Seidman's videos or somebody very similar doing some ridiculous shit, and they are watching, you know, maybe Athlete X, or maybe they're watching Dr. Berg, Joe Rogan, and all the rest, right? And this is not going to change, What you can control is whether you have the scientific literacy to address what they bring to you, and then calmly, confidently, and either with evidence behind you or very, you know, a lot of support from either books or research, experience, without dismissing them for engaging with that online content and say, hey, this is what actually needs to happen. This is how you make progress. I'm going to have to do this with parents relatively frequently as well. I want their kid to train some specific way. And it's like, well, your kid is 12. Your kid doesn't need some fancy neuromuscular kind of training, right? They need to learn how to squat and hinge and press and pull and do single leg work and overall just have a good general work capacity. That's what they need. They don't need anything crazy. And many of these other people mentioned will try to sell you this novelty stuff as well. And so your clients are probably going to see that, and they're going to ask you questions about it. But when a client asks you, say, about that 90-degree rule, you don't have to say that, hey, that's wrong. First, acknowledge that, hey, that's a great question. Here's generally what the range of motion research is suggesting about hypertrophy. And it actually shows that you can get more muscle. And here's how we're going to apply that to your training and keep your joints healthier because of it. So you turn what they're bringing to you into a coaching moment on your end to educate them on why this is what it is. They counteract this claim example by Seidman. And then it helps you build trust and then obviously retain clients over the long term. And then secondly, that your professional reputation depends on your ability to evaluate sources just in general. So the fitness industry is very, very saturated, right? It's everywhere. I mean, I scroll on Reels every now and then, and it's just ridiculous some of the people and things that I'm seeing on there. And these are people all apparently in my industry for the most part. That's basically all I'm served at this point on my social media. And there are thousands of coaches competing for all the same online clients in the same positions and the same authority. And what differentiates the great ones from all that noise is not the most exciting exercise library of random stuff or the most dramatic Instagram posts and flashy, catchy things. It's the ability to produce results at the end of the day, get people the results that they came to you for, and do a damn good job of actually training people, especially in real person, like in life, real people. There's something to be said about people that actually train physical, living human beings in person. It's a lot harder job than it is writing a training program and sending somebody and then wishing them the best over the next week and then just doing one check-in. Okay. You don't have to actually coach technique as much. You don't have to coach on the spot. You don't have to sell on the spot. You don't have to be engaged for a full 60 minutes, right? Those are all things that people don't understand. It's why in-person training costs significantly more than online training. But you also can, at the end of the day, going back to what I was saying, you can also explain why the results happen when people work with you. And then you can also cite different things of what guided your programming decisions. You know, I decided to use a concurrent training model because of XYZ, or I decided to use a block training model because XYZ, or I recommended they eat like this. We structured this around their training, right? You're able to explain why you did what you did. Now, if we're recommending exercises or methodologies that we can't explain either with evidence or from personal experience, then we could potentially be one question away from a client from losing credibility or potentially losing that potential client. And Seidman's content is a cautionary tale about what happens when marketing outpaces the evidence. And it's equally cautionary for coaches who adopt the content without doing their own critical analysis here. And then number three, this is the one I feel the most strongly about for sure, is that people who get hurt by this stuff are real. Okay, they are clients who paid money, who followed some bullshit protocol that he happened to make up and didn't get the results that they promised. And they were our athletes whose preparation was compromised by training methods that don't transfer to sport. There's nothing to back what he's doing. The research that he's claiming, a lot of time is very junk research. There was one that I looked up, it's been a while, but there's one that I looked up that the study was literally done on stroke patients. I'm sorry, dude, but we're not training stroke patients. At least majority of us aren't. Maybe they've had a stroke, but we're not doing anything on stroke patients, right? I've got a healthy, living, breathing person in front of me. I don't need whatever your BS citation that you pulled to back some stupid claim, right? I need research on healthy individuals that can actually exercise because that's who I'm actually training, all right? So to see these people that have paid that money, they did what this guy said and sold, and they didn't get the results. And then again, like I said, that their preparation was compromised by training methods that just don't work. They're sold lies about training methods that just truly don't work. There are coaches whose clients that came back with complaints, obviously, as well, like injuries, confusion from stuff like this. And they clearly don't have the foundation to course correct in the middle because they don't understand what's going on, because they outsourced all this information to, at the end of the day, what I'm going to call him is an influencer. And I hate to be that way because he's basically sold himself to be that way. Somebody's got a PhD that's clearly done like his internships and trained the right people and been in the right facilities. Like, he's clearly done a lot of really smart things. Like, sorry, but you're probably not just making up a PhD, right? Especially from the University of Georgia. So I don't back his, you know, deny his education. I think he's probably a very smart person. I think he has just fallen down a fitness influencer rabbit hole because it makes him a shit ton of money. Now, this is the dangerous part of the most dangerous influencer, in my opinion. It's not that Seidman is setting to harm anyone. Like, I don't think he's actually out there to hurt people. I'm not making that claim whatsoever. What I'm claiming is that the uncritical adoption of pseudoscientific methodology, especially when promoted with authority and confidence like Seidman does, causes real world harm to real world people. And that fitness professionals, we have a responsibility to act as the last line of defense against that, right? Our goal is to get people healthier and move better and feel better and live longer lives. And then we have somebody like Seidman, for example, who is giving terrible fitness advice to the average person. Maybe his stuff applies to the 0.5% of the people that he likes to train, but 99.5% of people watching don't need to do what Seidman's doing. But people think they do because, again, of his marketing, his PhD, his credentials, his following, that gets buy-in from people. And unfortunately, that is hurting people's progress. It could be causing issues with their joints or whatever. We don't really know, but I do think it's doing negative harm to the average person that's clearly trying to implement whatever it is that he's trying to sell at the time. And at the end of the day, us coaches and trainers, we are the ones with the education as well. Or we also have the capacity to build upon the education that we have. If we don't have enough of it, we can do some research and should be able to understand that stuff. But we're the ones in the room with the clients that we have. And we are the ones whose advice is going to shape their training. It's going to help build their confidence and sometimes their long-term health outcomes, adding years possibly onto their lives, getting them off medications, getting them moving better, preventing them from having surgeries, right? And that responsibility doesn't diminish because something looked impressive over on Instagram that Seidman did, unfortunately. So here's the standard that I think that we should try ourselves to, and that I personally try to hold myself to, is that before you incorporate any kind of exercise or protocol or claim into your coaching or your social media, you should ask yourself a couple questions. And that first question is, what does the research say about this? Is there any research out there, you know, when it comes to like full range of motion and partials? Like, where do you stand on that? How does that apply? Like, when it comes to reps and reserve of training, right? Or the anabolic window, like, you can think of all these things that have really seen research kind of shift. Do we have any literature to be able to support us and stand on some of our claims? Not that you have to always have research, but if there is research that backs you, that's obviously going to be one thing that's going to be very beneficial. Number two is then, again, what population was it studied on? And does that match my client, or is it something that I can use with some of my clients? Again, going back to the stroke patients, that one episode or that one study that I looked up that Seidman had, right? Like, I don't work with stroke patients. He doesn't work with stroke patients. So he's using a false claim there, which that also does not sit well with me. Understanding how any of the research that was studied on could potentially have use for other clients or the clientele that you work with. Doesn't always have to, but obviously it makes a better case for it, right? And then number three is, what is the opportunity cost? What am I giving up by doing this bullshit exercise that Seidman came up with versus the general strength exercise that it's trying to mimic, right? If he's doing with some weird ass squatty movement, not half squat, not to 90 degrees, whatever, with his eccentric isometrics, whatever, is there anything special there that's going to give me what I'm not getting? I have my clients do a traditional box squat or a goblet squat or a hex bar deadlift versus, you know, partial deadlift thing. Like, who knows, right? But I'm going to bet that the base is probably going to work because of the basics and they've lasted a really long time. And then with the opportunity cost is, what am I losing from my just trained hard anyways, right? There's nothing special about what he's doing that's going to give me that I'm not getting out of these major exercises to begin with. And so if you happen to run Seidman's 90-degree rule through that filter, using it as an example here, it's not going to live through that filter, right? If you run his chaos training through it as well, again, it's not going to work. And that's not, again, a personal attack on him. That's not really the goal of the episode here today. It's just the science. It's just the training. It's the same filter that you should be running everything that you happen to be seeing going through on Instagram, including what you happen to hear on this podcast, right? Again, this is my opinion. I try to use a little bit of research and practical experience, but I am not perfect. You can probably find something that is going to go against what I say or based upon the things that I've done with clients and athletes and myself, and you're absolutely right to do that. But the big thing I want you to take away here from this is that, you know, again, I'm not going after Seidman. It's the way that he's selling and presenting this stuff that I have an issue with. You know, he can be named anybody for all I care, but he's the popular one and the big one that we happen to see the most issues with. So let me give you the key takeaways here today before we wrap up this episode. The first one's going to be that Joel Seidman's 90-degree joint angle rule contradicts decades of research on range of motion, hypertrophy, and joint health. Okay, full range of motion training with appropriate load and technique produces superior outcomes for most and majority of healthy populations. Number two is that chaos training and maximal instability protocols do not produce superior strength or performance adaptations compared to stable progressive overload training. The research is consistent across the board here. The visual novelty is nothing but marketing. There's no science to support that's going to make you stronger or more powerful, especially from an athletic performance side. Then number three, that a credential does not automatically confer credibility on specific claims. So a PhD in exercise science in this case, paired with absolute claims that contradict the published literature that we happen to have, is still pseudoscience at the end of the day. So evaluate the evidence, not their badge, not the letters behind their name. Those just mean that they can pass exams, especially from the certification side. But even, you know, the PhDs and what have you, like, they definitely used to have a lot more credibility, but you don't know where they got it from, how they did it. Now, I'm assuming that his PhD was well done, but you know, I don't know what he got his PhD in, okay? I have a master's degree, right? So, you know, I did quite a bit of research for stuff, but is my master's degree as good as one from like a medical school? No, but it taught me how to read research and do those things, right? Like, I know I completed that degree. I've got the degree in hand. So, but I could use that and stand upon that what I'm saying is legit because I have a master's degree. Okay. So a lot of fitness influencers like to use that because they can stand upon that. I have a PhD. I've done years of research. I know how to read research, and this is what the research says. Okay. So don't fall into that trap, especially with someone like Seidman. And number four is that the business model side of the fitness influencers is often going to incentivize novelty over efficacy. Excuse me. So understanding how the content that we are consuming is monetized is going to help us evaluate it at the end of the day with the appropriate skepticism. So usually my rule of thumb is the more flashy it looks, it's more flash for cash. The more flash, the more cash that they're trying to grab. The more basic stuff does not do well. We know that the basics work consistently. And the reason those don't get a lot of flash is because everybody already knows them. It's nothing new. It's just the same old dog doing the same old tricks. All right? We're all doing that. But number five, our value as a coach is directly tied to our ability to think critically about information, communicate that thinking to clients, and then program from evidence rather than just the aesthetics or what we are seeing on social media and just blindly applying it to training programs and people that we see. So if this episode gave you something to think about, I would love to know personally. Drop a comment if you happen to be listening over on YouTube. Otherwise, do me a favor, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. It really does help show this episode and reach more fitness professionals and people who want to do things properly, get some proper education, really be in a like-minded space. That's what the Thirst for More podcast is really ultimately all about. And if you've got a topic that you want to dig into, you know, some kind of methodology, a claim, I guess for this episode, like a figure in the industry at this point, do me a favor and you can actually send that to me over on Instagram at bsmitley. That's bsmitley. Love to hear your thoughts. Would love to obviously connect with people and, you know, hear what you want to talk about, because I just come up with these podcast episodes as I make lists over the course of weeks of things I want to talk about and do the research and present it to you. So, you know, there's not really a rule or rhyme or reason of what I do. It's just what I want to talk about and hope that other people are willing to listen and take some stuff away. So if you send me a message and you want to talk about something, I'm definitely more in for that and all game for that as well. I'm definitely going to take the time to read that. So I'm your host, Brett Lee. This is the Thirst for More podcast. Thanks for tuning in and we'll see you at the next one. Thanks for listening to Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.